Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, what's happening in Poland on climate, and what does it mean that the U.S. will soon be out of the climate pact? Listen to the urgency in naturalist and filmmaker David Attenborough's message to the gathered nations.
The world's people have spoken. Their message is clear. Time is running out. They want you, the decision makers, to act now. They're behind you, along with civil society represented here today, supporting you in making tough decisions, but also willing to make sacrifices in their daily lives.
Okay, our conversation today, what are those tough decisions? What are those sacrifices? And as our guests guide the discussion, I'd like to hear your views to shape the conversation. What if increases in the price of gasoline, electricity, products, insurance was on the table in a plan to lower emissions? Now think hard. Would you be willing to spend more to create a more sustainable and ultimately carbon neutral world? Please don't just call in and go, it's worth it, whatever taxes we... I want you to really think hard about whether you'd pay a higher electricity bill, you'd spend more on insurance, products might be more expensive. Is it worth it? What do you think about this idea of the sacrifices that have to be made and ultimately will be asked of us? Here's the phone number, 800-242-2828, wherever you are. In our five-state region, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Maxine Burkhead is a professor of law at the University of Hawaii and a global fellow at the Wilson International Center for Scholars. And she's with us today from Hawaii in Honolulu. Maxine, wow, I know it's really early there. Thanks so much for joining the conversation. Really good to have you.
Yeah. It's great to be here. Good morning.
David Victor is with us. He's a professor of international relations at UC San Diego and co-director of the Laboratory on International Law and Regulation. And he's with us today from San Diego. And David, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Maxine, has the euphoria of Paris long since faded? And this is the moment where countries really have to wrestle with the nitty-gritty. What are they doing in Poland?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We had sort of a celebration in Paris with the fact that we could get the almost 200 countries to agree on serious action. That was a kind of a progressive action under the Paris Agreement. But it was very top line in terms of what it was committing the countries to. And the next step over almost three years, was to actually put specifics behind the very ambitious goals that were set in the Paris Agreement.
I'm hearing this referred to as a rule book, Maxine. I mean, what does that really mean?
Well, it's exactly what it means. What a rule book sort of suggests. I mean, the specific name is a Paris Agreement Work Program, right? And so they're essentially looking for how to set the rules for reporting back on promised emissions reductions, or reporting back on how much financing has increased or not from developed countries to developing countries, to the specifics around reporting on adaptation planning. So the details are there, and it's truly a rule book in the sense that every piece of the game has to be sorted through. We have hundreds of pages that the negotiators are sifting through right now that's been drafted over the years that have to actually be decided upon now.
David, you heard what David Attenborough said to the delegates, and what I guess I want to know is whether that is true or it's aspirational. The world's people are behind you. They're willing to make sacrifices. They're willing to do what it takes. Is that true right now?
Yeah, I think it's a mix. I love David Attenborough. It's always wonderful to hear his voice.
Wonderful.
I think the world's scientists have spoken. That's very clear. And the science is getting stronger and stronger and scarier and scarier. The people haven't really spoken. If you ask people structured polls, you know, you're worried about climate change, they'll say yes. They're worried about lots of things. Ask people, are you willing to spend money on it? They'll say yes. And then when you design surveys to look at what people are really willing to spend, what you see is a much narrower pool of people that are willing to do something. And they're mainly in the Western industrial countries. In the rest of the world, people are worried about other things that are related to climate change, like local air pollution. But the kind of broad-based global social movement is not there.
I mean, when you say at the moment it is a narrow sliver of the world's people willing to commit, I suppose that has to be front and center in the minds of these delegates as they start to commit to these rules, David, yeah?
Yeah, and that's precisely why the rule book negotiations are so difficult, is that there are some parts of the rule book that are relatively straightforward. You know, how do you report data on emissions? And there are other parts of it, how much detail should be included in reports about the policies that countries are putting into place? How should we review that information? Should countries that are falling short be spotlighted or penalized in some way? Those are the really difficult questions. And absent a strong, broad-based political movement to do something about the problem, those are the kinds of issues that, you know, the Trump administration has been allergic to, parts of Europe are allergic to, almost all the emerging economies are allergic to. And that's kind of why it's easy to be euphoric after the Paris Agreement, where we all agree we're going to do something, and then hard to be realistic.
Yeah. Call here from Josh in Minneapolis. Hi, Josh. How do you see this?
Hey, I kind of feel like it does need to be raised a little bit, but there's only so far they can go. Otherwise, there'll be too much pushback on it. And kind of like in France, how they have all the riots and stuff from it.
From a fuel increase, yeah?
Yeah, okay. From like raising the cost of everything.
Josh, I think this is a good point. Maxine, we're seeing in Paris right now the kind of reaction that President Macron got when he wanted to raise fuel prices.
That's right. There are a couple of points that are really critical here that I'd really like to address, and they're related to this question about whether or not there's sort of the public will there. What's happening in France is as much an equity issue as it is about sort of the specifics of a gas tax, right? Whether or not it's pushback against climate action versus the lack of engagement and community sort of investment in terms of talking to those that would be most impacted, making sure that the policy is not regressive. These are policy questions that can be sorted through. And there's evidence that the French government just didn't do its work in terms of engaging the relevant people that would be most impacted. I don't think it's a referendum on and willingness to act on climate change. And in fact, there have been efforts to have coalitions of both sort of Labour and Green parties to talk about the shared future, one in which sort of the present day is so linked and clearly linked to the, you know, sort of the viability of our future environments, our work environments as well. So it's really critical to understand that we're talking about this element of just transitions that has to be part and parcel of any policy planning that happens. How do we make this transition in a way that brings everyone along? And in fact, is especially concerned about lower income peoples or people that are working deeply in the industries that are going to be most affected by our decarbonization of the economy. That's really critical. I think, too, that when we see the sort of questions around who cares about climate change, certainly in the international negotiations, we know that developing countries, especially the least developed countries, especially island nations, especially those that have been hit by super typhoons or massive desertification, that there is a real concern about climate change and there's a real interest, intense interest in fixing this. This is, in some ways, the issue of a global community having to organize itself, but with significant headwinds. And those headwinds, frankly, are fossil fuel industries as well as the countries that are deeply entrenched and intertwined with those interests.
You know, I really hear what you said about, as you think about who cares about climate change, the people, the nations and the citizens who care about climate change may also not be the same nations that can incur the deepest costs, right? So sometimes I hear this talked about, like, well, everybody's going to have to make the sacrifice. Well, the wealthier nations and the bigger emitters probably have to make the deepest sacrifice, even if they don't care as much about the climate situation, the U.S. at the moment, as some of these other nations that can't make those deepest sacrifices. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this has actually been in the fabric of the agreement since the beginning, since the Framework Convention, some 26 years ago now. And this is, it was drafted by with the help of the George H.W. Bush administration, the notion of common but differentiated responsibilities. And the understanding that, whether it was historical emissions or current capacity in terms of addressing climate change, it doesn't map equally across the globe. Those that have emitted less are having greater impacts. Those that have emitted more are having fewer impacts, or those impacts are easier to adapt to or to recover from than they are in other parts of the world. And so built into the spirit of this entire agreement is this understanding that different countries are faring differently and will have a harder time with the climate changes.
Cameron says on Twitter, things being more expensive with a carbon tax is sort of the point, isn't it? Consumers should show resistance to paying more, which makes less carbon-intensive alternatives more attractive for corporations to develop. And Michael says, we're already paying a high price for not fighting climate change. Wildfires, hurricanes, droughts, etc. We must be willing to pay more for clean energy if needed. The good news, clean energy will become cheaper as it's more widely adopted. David, would you just weigh in on the economics there behind Michael's observation? Is he right?
Yeah, I think he's right. I mean, the whole idea behind a carbon tax or some other policy instrument to encourage reductions in emissions is to make higher carbon, higher polluting activities more expensive and then create an incentive to innovate. And that's starting to happen, especially happening in the countries, Norway, Sweden, a handful of others that have very high carbon taxes and other policies, California for that matter, New York, the Northeast. And so we're starting to see that, but it's highly variable. Many of the technologies that are part of a lower carbon future, including renewable energy technology, energy efficiency, those costs are coming down. There are interesting new things going on in the nuclear power industry, new kinds of designs. In the emerging economies, China and Korea in particular, nuclear power is actually very attractive from a cost point of view. So there's a lot of this happening. The problem still is that people can be concerned about the impacts of climate change, like wildfires, and then still it's difficult to organize politically the coalition needed to put into place the emission control policies. And that's exactly what we're seeing in France. Is every country's politics is different, but every country is now kind of clutching and gearing and trying to deal with those differences as they struggle to put real policies into place.
You know, David, when I think about how you've described this, I think about the people that continue to build beautiful homes on the coasts of Florida and the Carolinas. I think many of them would say they believe the science and they're concerned about the future of this, but they don't want to pay higher insurance, for build. I mean, it's a lot of, on a macro level, yeah, I'm concerned about this. When you get right back down to my own personal pocketbook on this, I don't want to have to bear the cost for this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. That's the essence of why this is a hard problem to address, is that from a global collective perspective, we all have an intense and growing interest in doing something about the problem. And from a narrow perspective, people want to live on the coast with a view. They want to use high carbon fuels at low cost and so on. I do think if politicians don't pay close attention to the politics, the backlash could be very aggressive. We've seen this in France. We're about to see this in the coastal zones where you've got some places. California is probably the lead here, that are trying to organize a managed retreat from the coastline at sea level. And that's, that could be the new Sagebrush Rebellion, this kind of idea that the government is out of control and they're trying to take away our property, all for some abstract global good. And that could really build a political opposition that's even stronger than what we see already.
We're taking note, if you've just gotten in on the show, of this meeting that is going on in Poland. It's the follow to the Paris climate discussions that went on. And now these are nations really doing the hard nitty gritty work of trying to come up with a rule book that nations will agree to with an aim of reducing the acceleration of climate warming, global warming. We're talking with David Victor, Professor of International Relations at UC San Diego, and Maxime Burkett, Professor of Law at the University of Hawaii, about what's going on in Poland, the latest data, the most recent data that we've gotten on global warming from the Trump administration, the report that they tried to bury, and some other information that's been coming out about this. And then I'm asking you about when you hear someone like David Attenborough say, hey, sacrifices are going to have to be made, tough decisions are going to have to be taken. What happens if that affects your own pocketbook? Increases in the price of gasoline, electricity, products, insurance. How deep would you be willing to dig? I know this is a self-selected audience. Our listeners are interested in climate science and probably willing to dig in. But think about the overall scope of that. How deep would you be willing to dig on this? And what questions do you have about it? 651-227-6000 on Twitter at @CarrieNPR to Mickey in Plymouth. Hi, Mickey. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. The biggest thing is that I see is the unknowns. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody says they want change, but I don't necessarily want to pay for it. But when it comes down to it, until we see the cost, you don't know. And if it really does come to, oh my gosh, I'm paying $2 more to fill up my car, mm-hmm. will people even notice that they're paying $2 more to fill up their car? And that's the key, is that unless you notice it, you don't feel it.
Yeah, Maxine, the unknown, that's a really good point about this.
That's right. I mean, there is an element of this that's, you know, the sort of question mark as to how you plan your day, your week, your year, what the costs are in terms of your personal budget. I mean, I think what's important to understand is that had we sort of acted with as much intention and speed decades ago when we knew that this was a problem, and the presidential administration's back before Johnson had been briefed on the potential impacts of climate change, had we started making these transitions, that would have been a much less steep sort of curve in terms of over time the increases in costs, right? We could have incorporated that. The transition to renewables would have been, I think, much more seamless and not as sort of immediately impactful. What we're seeing now is also important to recognize as the need to address a pretty dire circumstance in much less time than we actually had to act. And so it's probable that these shifts are going to happen in a way that may be more abrupt. And the key will be for there to be policy that better sort of channels people's decision-making, right, so that the cost indications are clear before people decide to build on the coastlines. We need policies like just transition policies that allow for people that are working in the fossil fuel industry to have options that are alternatives to, you know, digging coal or extracting oil and gas, and that gets them into renewables or energy efficiency positions that can buffer that. Policy that also allows for, say, tax and dividends, so that whatever kind of revenue comes from it doesn't go straight to the government. It goes to the people, and especially those that are most impacted that have a high reliance on the carbon economy right now.
Yeah,
So there are ways to make that transition.
I'm going to come back to the idea of the carbon tax here in just a minute, Maxine. But what you said about the arc of the curve, the action on this, is echoed in the report that the Trump administration put out. I mean, it says, under actions to reduce risks, this assessment shows that more immediate and substantial global greenhouse gas emission reductions, as well as regional reductions, would be needed to avoid the most severe consequences in the long term. I mean, what they are really saying there is if we'd gotten on this 25 or 30 years ago, we wouldn't be in the urgent situation we're in now, which means the fix is going to be that much more painful. Is that how you interpret it?
That's absolutely right, and you can extrapolate that out into the future. I mean, we're talking about a sort of a debt that's coming due, right? And the interest on it is pretty substantial, and we're either paying for it now or the older versions of ourselves are paying for it. And it is happening in our lifetime. And so at this point, the question isn't really at all, you know, should we do something, should we not do something? Well, you know, what will it cost, and do I have, can I bear that? The question is, are our politicians, are our leaders going to actually step up and pay what's due so that the circumstances for us, the economic impacts, the impacts of post-disaster preparation or post-disaster cleanup and all of the things that we're seeing right now that are costing people greatly in terms of their lives and their money and suffering, those things are going to need to be accounted for, and we have to do that now or else it will get much, much worse.
Call here from Stefan in Cottage Grove. Hey, Stefan, hi.
Good morning.
Hi. What do you want to say?
You know, I'm in my 40s, and I have to say I've had a pretty decent life, and I've enjoyed a lot of good things.
Mm-hmm.
But I also do have a toddler, so I kind of worry about his future. And, you know, I've heard the number 2030 is kind of the point of no return. And I just worry that, you know, by the time he's in his teens, what kind of quality of life is he going to have? And, yeah, I really think that I'm willing to dig deep in my pockets so I can eventually meet my grandchildren and, you know, have the quality of life that I've enjoyed. So I think it is pretty important for myself and my family and everyone who's involved.
You know, David, Stefan put that well, and here's the tension. We are not good at making sacrifices today for a future that's, you know, off in the distance. But he's really articulated why the stakes are so high.
Yeah, we're not wired to be good at that, but we're better at it when we change the default rules. We're better at it when we put policies in place that then create incentives to improve the technology so that changing becomes less expensive and then politically easier to do. And so I think that's what folks are trying to, the practical people are trying to do right now, and that's still very, very hard. I will say one thing about the science here, mm-hmm. which is I think both the scientific community and maybe especially the press has misrepresented the nature of the underlying science here. It's not that
meaning,
there's a year that we know where there's a point of no return. What we know is that warming has accelerated. There's a team of us that had a little essay in Nature last week about this. It's accelerated a lot, and so we're going to get to the 1.5 degree level sooner than people originally expected, probably 2030, maybe earlier. And so the effects of climate change are going to rise, but there's not a single kind of threshold beyond that, known threshold beyond which everything changes. And so that's the kind of reality that we need to grapple with, which is that the benefits of expensive actions to cut emissions are kind of still abstract to most people.
Right.
And that's the until it's made less abstract, and maybe events like the wildfires help make it less abstract, it's going to be hard to get folks to think.
Go ahead, please, Maxine.
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in really quickly because it is important to recognize that these numbers are just benchmarks, right? They're round numbers to have us sort of have a sense of what does this next decade look like? What does that decade look like? And it's an effort to kind of crystallize for people the time scales. And it's sort of a rough effort just by definition, but it doesn't say anything about the underlying science. So that's really critical, right? So the science is not uncertainty about whether or not it's happening or whether or not it's going to be worse than it is today. That's clear. And the numbers themselves, it's true, don't suggest that, you know, January 1st, 2030, all of a sudden the world has changed. Same with the sea level rise projections, the projections around heat increases. It's just to suggest that over these periods of time that we recognize as major benchmarks and, you know, sort of in our future, right, these are things that we can imagine happening. And so even the 2100 number is misleading in that after 2100, there is still even more that we're set to experience. But we use that as a benchmark because it rounds out the century that we're living in.
Brandon says on Twitter, a third of Americans' household income is $35,000 or lower. I would love to pay more, but I could not. I live 30 minutes away from where I work, and if the cost of living went up, I would have to quit. I sympathize with the yellow jackets, he means in Paris. It's the government's job to help their people. I'd like to know whether you two believe that for the moment, in most nations around the world, a carbon tax just is not politically viable. Maxine?
Yeah, I mean, this is a tough one, right? Because the cost, as has been mentioned by the callers as well, is maybe acute in certain instances, right? So the costs of major hurricanes coming through and your crop being destroyed, or your environment, the toxic burden that you're experiencing, say in North Carolina, increases. These are acute spaces in which we're feeling the cost of climate change. I understand the specific questions around the carbon tax in terms of viability are really difficult, but there are places like we saw on this past election day in the state of Washington where there might be interest, but there are, again, a significant headwinds in the ability to have a sound conversation about what this would look like. I'm completely sympathetic to the concerns about those who are thinking, look, how do I get to work? How do I get my kids to school? How do I put food on the table? And the issue here is that there isn't sufficient policy to correct for those impacts. And it's possible. It's not an impossible thing to do. It's just a necessary part of the decision-making that needs to happen. And honestly, if it doesn't happen in the political space, in the legislative branches, and the negotiation tables internationally, it's going to continue in the courtroom.
Yeah. David, do you accept the idea that most economists, there seems to be consensus among economists that if you really want to get to less emissions in a foreshortened amount of time, the carbon tax is the way to get there. Do you agree with that or not?
Yeah, so, and I've been very heavily involved in that work. I would say almost all of us agree that some kind of price instrument, a tax or cap and trade system. I and many other people favor a tax for technical reasons, but I think that's right. But I think the politics of this remain very difficult. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the reasons why politically most jurisdictions that are making a big dent in emissions or trying to make a big dent in emissions are mostly using traditional regulation, in part because the cost of it is more hidden from the public. I will say that there, you asked the question of, you know, is a tax feasible? There are some places that have taxes already. I mentioned Norway and Sweden. There's not a long list, but there are places that are starting to put these systems into place, or they have cap and trade systems that are in effect like taxes. I think one of the problems remains that there's a kind of trade-off in the design of the tax. If you want to make the tax as pure as possible, mm-hmm. then it makes it very, very transparent, and the politics in this area don't do well with sunlight.
Meaning
that if you make the cost extremely transparent,
uh-huh.
then the opposition gets organized politically. And so all the smart work, in my view, all this kind of politically smart work that's being done around carbon taxes and cap and trade is looking not just at pure instruments, but looking at how you would design them to rebate money back to the public, to make them more supportive, to set aside funds, to help retrain workers. You know, the places that have done really well in this area, like Finland, for example, they have active programs to take people who are in the coal industry and teach them other jobs so that they don't become opponents of the policy measures.
Yeah. Call here from Josh in La Crosse. Josh, you're thinking about this carbon tax idea?
Well, I guess my thinking is exactly what David just said. Like, he just explained exactly why a carbon tax is not only workable, but also in the interests of the people who are paying it in terms of refunding dividends and retraining and then investing in technological transfers that will alleviate this kind of climate change in the future. So I guess I'm just not really sure why, when you shine sunlight on this, that it doesn't become feasible. Like, isn't it the job of our political leaders just to tell people who misunderstand basic economics that they're wrong
oh
and that they should and be quiet? And you know, it's perplexing to me why a bunch of ignorant voters are in charge of setting global climate policy.
Maxine, please answer that, because I think we've touched on it a bit already.
Yeah, I mean, what's happening is not necessarily... I hear the frustration. I think what we're seeing here is that, you know, we're coming out of decades of a lot of sort of lack of clarity, whether it's about the question of whether climate change happening or not. This is relatively recently, I think, that we can be talking about it in a way that clearly establishes among all listeners that this is actually happening, and that's not a question mark, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, after the federal report came out, the climate assessment came out, there were a number of deniers that were brought into the news media. So we have a little bit of an issue with just the discussion piece of it. So the ignorance on the part of anyone is probably understandable, on top of there being very scary information that they have to integrate into their lives and major changes. So we're dealing with a sort of interesting push and pull. We're also dealing, frankly, with the fact that there are massively powerful oppositional forces here, right? I mean, if we're thinking about the state tax carbon tax measure in Washington State, I mean, those that were advancing that provision were outspent by tens of millions of dollars by the fossil fuel industry.
Wow.
I think it's important to recognize that that is a really steep hill to climb when you're trying to get sound policy, never mind having very sound arguments about how it would make sense and how it could be relatively seamless, less painful, but with dividend policies or with retraining policies. All of these things are completely obscured by much easier sort of narratives around how costly it'll be and that the government's not looking out for you and that there's some kind of agenda. These are larger forces, again, that the sound and smart argument are working against.
Call here from Tom in Matamidi. Hi, Tom. What's
Hello.
The question you want to put in here?
Oh, I had two things. One is that I really wish we'd frame it more in a framework of being an opportunity rather than all this fear of where we're going and how we're not going to get there because people won't put up with it. If we have opportunity where we're going to change our whole economic system and go toward something where we're not having our military support the price of oil and on and on and on. You know, like, just think about it. We spent $21 trillion in the last 20 years on wars that basically support the military oil complex.
Tom, if I might, I only have a couple minutes left. And what you said about, you know, presenting this as more of an opportunity, you know, David, President Obama did that. He talked constantly about investment in green energy and competition with China. And still these powerful forces that Maxine just talked about lined up against that. I'm not so sure it's as simple as changing the vocabulary on this.
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, we describe things and then suddenly the scales fall from the eyes and everybody knows which way to march. But I think the caller's point about opportunity is right. We're seeing more industries that see an opportunity in this, in renewables, in advanced nuclear, electric vehicles, batteries connected to the grid, storage connected to the grid of other types and so on. So that's now emerging. It's taking a while to get organized. To me, one of the most interesting things going on right now globally is that the Chinese see a massive opportunity here, not because they're worried about climate change, but they're worried about other things in the energy space, and they're trying to build new industries around renewables. So there's a massive Chinese investment that's becoming much more efficient in the way it deploys capital to try and build new industries here. And this, the more that there's a kind of industrial politics around decarbonization, the more we're going to see acceleration in the emissions control program.
David, really appreciative for your part in the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, my pleasure.
And Maxine, I have 2 minutes left. Will you speak to what David was saying about China?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as with all things, it's really critical to understand the difference between leaders, the leaders that are at these negotiating tables, and those that are at the hands of the, you know, the impacts of climate change on the day-to-day level. What we see in China is sort of an interesting mixed political space, where I think there is a genuine concern about a sort of an ecological future for the Chinese, and a real commitment to having that infuse their policy and their economy. But there's also obviously high emissions, but major opportunity in terms of shifting the market. So I think that's right on. Just to the issue of opportunity, though, I think there's one eye to the opportunity. And unfortunately, probably the most unfortunate part of our current political state here in the United States is that there isn't that sort of sense of opportunity in any respect, I think, in really critical ways. I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, if I were to show my children the rotary phone versus the iPhone, they're going to look at me like, what are you talking about? Right now, we're being shown the rotary phone, and we're being told that that's the future, but that's obviously not the future that we can provide our young people. And I think that their sense of where we are in terms of possibility and rapid change will be different. And not to wait on them, but to certainly provide pathways for them to accelerate that change is going to be critical.
Maxine, thank you so much for getting up early in Hawaii. I'm so glad you were part of the discussion, and I hope you'll come back. Really, really great to
Absolutely.
Have you. Thank
Thanks
you.
So much.
Maxine
right.
Burkett with us, professor of law at the University of Hawaii. Hey, if you got in the middle of the show, we covered a lot of territory, including the political junkie at the top. You can find the whole show. You can just listen to the junkie part of that on the podcast. How to do it? Search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you listen.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!